And we're back. This is Ruthie on Tell Us. And today we're interviewing Ian Williams. Ian is a senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. And he wrote, for those rum lovers amongst you, he wrote Rum, a Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776. Mr. Williams, join us.
Happy to be with you.
And where are you exactly right now?
I'm in New York, overlooking the Hudson. I'm watching New Jersey. New Jersey has its moments. This is one of the few ones, just towards sunset.
How lovely. How lovely. And you hail from?
Liverpool.
Home of the Beatles.
Yes, and as mentioned when we were talking earlier, my youth club turned them down because the greedy suds wanted £40 for a gig, and we got the Searchers for 20 instead. The going rate for a group at the time, to put it in perspective, was £3, £3 shillings, which was what, about less than $10. That got you a whole, you know,
a whole band.
a whole band.
And the Beatles wanted $10.
Oh, they wanted more. I mean, you know, £40 was that's close to 20.
Oh, no.
50 to 20. I mean, who did they think they are?
That's wild.
No, in fact, it's more than that. £40 was sick. That was almost $80.
Oh, yeah, that 80. Was way too much for the Beatles then, I'm sure. Anyway, let's get back to rum. Williams wrote Rum, a Social and Sociable History of the Real Spirit of 1776. Let's start there. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, as you can tell from the accent, it means I don't have to buy into local history, even though I've been here since 1989. But when I was researching the history of rum, I was looking at the American Revolution, and it was not about tea. Not even the British fight was about Earl Grey. In 1776, it was in fact duty-free tea being thrown overboard by smugglers to protect the fact that they were trying to sell more expensive smuggled tea. The real issue in 1776 was rum, molasses, and slaves. The Yankee merchants in New England in particular wanted to be able to import molasses from the French colonies and make it into rum and sell it buy slaves with it in West Africa. And that doesn't really comport with the self-image of people fighting for freedom and, you know, give me liberty or give me death. Oh, by the way, can you buy those 6 slaves with 2 barrels of rum on your next trip, please? It just somehow doesn't ring well, does it?
Oh, my. Go on.
Well, I got into the history of rum going right back to its start in Barbados in 1640. And, you know, of course, I actually like rum. So it was, you know, how should we say, a hands-on research experience across the Caribbean and up New England as we checked out where and how it had shaped the history of the era. Washington wrote a letter to one of his officers reprimanding him for trying to give the troops French wine. He said, you know, don't be silly, man. No sensible soldier is going to fight with wine. They need rum inside them.
Well, that's a bit of rum history for this morning. But one of the reasons that I was very interested in talking to Ian Williams is because he is also responsible for one of the first internet TV shows on foreign TV portraying Hemingway's bars and drinking holes in Havana specifically. Tell us about that.
Well, ForeignTV.com was a brave new venture, which was started by, I think, Peter Arnett was one of the people. There were a whole group of correspondents from the glory days and Network News, a few others. They came together. Their problem was that they had a brilliant idea and they set up a brilliant series of shows, but this was when people were still relying on dial-up connections, so it was awful if you were trying to watch it on a computer. And I was one of their correspondents. I went to Cuba and I had the bright idea. I got a film student from the film school in Cuba to act as my cameraman, and we followed in the wobbly footsteps of Hemingway from bar to bar through Havana into the Floridita and the others, and we spoke to the barman and even the historian of Cuban rum who had gone out fishing with Hemingway in the old days. So you know, that was that was fun, checking out the margaritas and all of the other drinks in places like the Floridita.
I can imagine. And also, Ian was sharing with us that he ran into Fidel Castro at the United Nations during the 90s, and they were at the Cuban mission in New York City. And Fidel remembered him from his days in Cuba because he was he's a redhead and he wore his long red beard. And Fidel nicknamed him El Vikingo, the Viking. Is that correct?
It is indeed, yes. And, you know, I was quite proud. My Swedish great-grandfather would have been proud of me, I'm sure.
Oh, my goodness.
If they'd had the good sense to go down to the Caribbean, you'd never got rid of the Vikings.
The reason that I called you immediately was because you've been talking about the condemnation of Cuba and things in general about this embargo. It's now, what, 52 years old?
Yes, it's one of the most pointless embargoes ever. I mean, I've been in Cuba several times. I have interviewed and worked with quite a lot of the dissidents there. And there's nobody in Cuba, the dissidents included, that thinks that this is anything other than a travesty. It makes things hard for ordinary people and gives my chum Fidel an excuse for the complete inefficiencies of, Cuba is an incredibly fertile country. It's a place where if you wandered past in the morning and spit, by the evening there's a spit tree growing. So you've got patches of earth in the world where half the land, I think, on the last count was fallow. And they can, every time somebody complains about the soy burgers they're having to eat, they just say, el bloqueo, the blockade.
Right.
Give them an excuse.
But this is important. The Associated Press reports that the United Nations General Assembly on Tuesday voted overwhelmingly to condemn the United States commercial, economic, and financial embargo against Cuba for the 21st year in a row. And at this point, it's embarrassing because the final tally Tuesday last week was 188-3. And those three were the United States, Israel, and Palau. Now, that's embarrassing. Three holdouts when the entire world feels it's time to stop this ridiculous embargo. I think they're just holding it out of tradition. What do you think?
Well, it's because American foreign policy has very little to do with foreigners or the real world. It is to do with lobbies and in the Cuban American lobby of the exiles in Florida, as you are well aware, being there, is very powerful. And this has become an act of faith for them that they have to maintain the blockade. And they regard everybody who didn't leave with them as somehow treacherous. But it's not no way to win hearts and minds. You know, I've been there, and the poverty in Cuba is very serious. A lot of those people depend upon the remittances from their relatives in the States. And most of their relatives in the States want to send money. So this is a minority holding the foreign policy of the United States hostage and also strangling their compatriots back home. You know, about they hate... Let's say they hate Fidel far more than they love the Cubans.
Oh, it sounds like a parental alienation story to me when two parents are fighting with each other and they hate each other more than they love the kids.
Something like that, yes.
They say that there's a bit of a weakening there with the loss of David Rivera. Is that right?
There's no support for this blockade anywhere except in the Cuban-American and the Florida congressional delegation, and it's held hostage over and over again. The biggest thing at the moment, which rum, since we may as well return to our rum, our rum menu.
Yes, let's.
Many rum drinkers in the United States, rum aficionados, are upset because they cannot legally import Havana Club rum. Now, you know, I actually think that Havana Club rum is good, but it's not as brilliant as many people think.
Okay, wait a minute. That's another thing I wanted to ask you about that's really, really important. I want to know why the Havana Club is not allowed into the United States. Tell us about that in detail.
Well, because of the blockade. There are two reasons. One is it's a produce of Cuba, and anything that's produced in Cuba is banned from importing here, even though, because of pressure from the agricultural lobby, We sell them lots of food. We sell them wheat. We sell them rice. We sell them cattle fodder, I believe, in large quantities. No one is stupid enough to actually go across the farm lobby and say, by the way, we don't want you to sell this stuff to Fidel. But with the rum is that Bacardi bought up from the company that used to make Havana Club their claim to the title, which they'd let lapse, by the way. And it was thrown out in every court everywhere else in the world. But the Bacardi company, especially the older generation, still have monstrous grudges. People forget, by the way, that Bacardi actually bankrolled Fidel Castro and the Sierra Maestra. You know, they actually sent checks to the rebels and they greeted him when he came in, when he came into Santiago de Cuba with big banners, and even came on his first trade delegation. And
oh, you're giving away all the Bacardi secrets.
Well, it's there in the history books. And then, of course, they got a little upset with some understandable justification because Fidel confiscated their rum distilleries. But Bacardi was very clever. They'd already offshored from Cuba beforehand and they brought all of their copyrights out with them. But they didn't have this one. They only in the American courts have they won. And the only reason they've won in the American courts to secure the trademark to Havana Club is by basically bribing Congress. Every time the courts knock down the trademark claim on Havana Club, then someone in Washington alters one of those huge bills and shoves in wording that plugs the gap. So they don't. They actually have the rights to make and sell a Havana Club in Miami, I presume, or in or from Puerto Rico. But they bar the Cuban product from coming into the country. You know, and I think the younger generation of the Bacardis are actually much more savvy. It's just that they've spent so much money on this now that they feel they should actually get something back from it. And my bet is that when things open up in a year or two, they'll cut a deal with the French company that has the distribution rights for Havana Club, and that money checks will change hands, and Bacardi will probably distribute the Cuban stuff here in the United States. I think the... The ideological fires are dying down now. As you said, it's been over 50 years.
The way it's been put, and wisely so, President Obama doesn't owe that group anything. He can use his influence now.
Well, yes, the Cubans in Florida are almost the only group of Hispanic voters and speakers in the country that vote consistently Republican. You know, a majority, overwhelming majority Republican. And what's happened is they're getting outnumbered. They're being outnumbered by Mexicans and Dominicans and all the people from the other Spanish countries who fall back into voting Democrats. And they know that there's little love lost between them and the Cuban Americans. So this is, as we saw, President Obama actually won the Florida Electoral College seats. Not that he did it for good because he'd already got enough, but that's a sign of, I think, diminishing influence. He won Florida despite the Cuban blockade supporters, not because of them. He owes them nothing. And he's already started extenuating the embargo. And I think, as always, he's got to push against Congress, and the people in the congressional delegation will try to jump up and down and swing from the chandeliers about it. But I think we'll see a diminution. And this doesn't mean he likes Fidel Castro or likes his human rights policies. I personally think there's nothing better to open up Cuba than lots of tourists going there and lots of Cuban Americans going there with the message that you do not have to wallow in poverty and call it socialism, that you can actually have a good lifestyle and still vote freely.
Oh, I absolutely agree. This has been a report from our new Liverpool correspondent, Ian Williams, known as El Vikingo by Fidel himself, the Viking.
All right, then. See you again sometime, eh?
Say that again.
I am Ian Williams, and I'm here on syndicatednews.net. Thank you.
By its originator and author, Orlando Delgado, also known as Landy Nova. He was a professional musician in the 70s with Fania Records, and his paperwork has been inherited by Código, I believe, and we're going to be following up on where Landy Nova's actual royalties are. Someone's receiving them. We're going to look into who real soon.